This is the Berkeley Signal.
The government wants to close them down, but we want them to stay. They're playing sounds that we all like, so don't take them away.
When you're walking down the street with your transistor radio, everybody has a good time. You can dance to the beat of your transistor radio, even when the sun don't shine. You can hear your favorite rock and roll, rhythm and blues with a lot of soul. Some swinging DJs playing top 40 records, they can really turn you on. Now the government's trying to close down the stations. What'll happen when they're gone? You won't hear the music that you like any old time of day or night.
The 2018 U.S. midterm elections mark a critical point in the era of Trump. The potential Democratic takeover of the House of Representatives has unleashed a torrent of white supremacist vitriol that is without precedent in recent years.
To talk about what's at stake on Tuesday, we're joined by longtime investigative journalist Alan Nairn. Talk about the state of affairs in this country right now.
Well, this midterm election, this is it. The U.S. is facing incipient domestic fascism. The rightist revolution that Trump dragged to power has a chance to consolidate itself. The way to stop it is to vote the Democrats into control of at least one and preferably both houses of Congress.
It's interesting you say that because you've been a fierce critic of Democrats.
Yeah. For years, I've been documenting how many of the senior Democrats are complicit in war crimes, how they belong in prison. But we are now in an emergency situation in which there's a huge fundamental difference between the Democrats and the Republicans at this moment. The Republicans would abolish democracy because that's the only way they can perpetuate their power. They have a minority of the votes. They have to rig the system so they can stay in power as their minority of votes diminishes over time. The Democrats, their interest is in maintaining, even expanding democracy because that will help bring them to power. Secondly, there's the element that Trump personally has brought to power. When he dragged the Koch brothers and the Paul Ryans and the American oligarchs to power, he did it with a two-pronged platform. One was punching the elites in the nose, as the banker Jamie Dimon put it. The other was racism. Without the element of punching the elites in the nose, the Republicans could never have won the election. Romney tried running the elitist platform of giving tax breaks to the rich, getting rid of Social Security, Medicare. He lost. They can't win with that. But Trump presented himself as someone who, A, will support social justice and who had the capacity to unleash the beast within white America. So he dragged the American rich into power. They came with a pre-programmed plan to make an even more massive shift of government resources and taxpayers' money to the richest people in the country. You know, there are just three individuals now whose wealth is equal to that of the bottom 50% of the American population. I mean, it's already insane, but the Republican core value is to make it worse. And secondly, he did it by unleashing these fascistic forces in the American population, in the American grassroots. There are many good Democratic candidates in this election, people who in one way or another will represent a breakthrough for social justice, who all have essentially pledged to support Social Security, Medicare, Obamacare, Medicaid, when the Republicans would abolish it. But also, a substantial number of these Democrats are arguably war criminals, not as big as the war criminals on the Republican side, but still war criminals, and they belong in prison. But we are facing such a crisis in this country at this moment that you have to use your head. You have to be tactical. You have to, at this moment, vote in the warmongers who will preserve democracy to block the warmongers who would abolish it. And then the day after the election, go back to the deeper work of creating real, better, more constructive political alternatives and also helping the base of the Democratic Party take back the party from the consultants, from the rich donors. But that's for the day after the election is completed, and maybe the runoffs in Georgia and Mississippi, if they happen, after those are completed. Right now, the task is to stop the incipient fascism that Trump and the rightist revolution represents. And you can't really say that you were working toward an anti-fascist goal if you're not mobilizing for the Democrats right now. That's the urgent reality that we're living.
I mean, you've even suggested, Alan, that depending on how things go next week in the midterms, that there could be a far more progressive left government in power in just a few years in the U.S. Could you explain why you think that is?
Well, it's because of the collapse of the American middle class. It was the collapse of that American middle class, heavily linked to neoliberal policies, that made Sanders and Trump the two most dynamic candidates in the 2016 election. They were the only two that recognized the reality that the American middle class, the prosperous working class, had been gutted. Everyone else, Clinton, all the other Republican candidates, were talking fantasy, trying to believe that this hadn't happened. So those two emerged very strongly. Now, their solutions were opposite. Sanders was talking about constructive solutions. Trump was posing as an enemy of the elites when he wasn't. He was actually the embodiment of the worst, the most criminal aspects of the American oligarchs. And he was simultaneously saying, we'll help solve this with racism. Now, though, in this campaign, there's an interesting change in the Trump-Republican strategy. They've dropped the punch the elites in the nose part, and they're running on the straight-up racism, the anti-immigrant hysteria. There's really nothing else there. It's important to note that the immigration issue itself is phony. It's a complete fake. If you're actually looking at facts, there is no immigration issue. I cite as my source on this Sean Hannity. After Romney was defeated by Obama in the 2012 election, Hannity immediately went on his radio show saying he, Sean Hannity, now favored a path to citizenship, which is what the progressive immigration activists had been pushing. He said, we've got to drop the immigration issue. I mean, his diagnosis was that, A, the immigration problem is not a national security threat to the United States. If Sean Hannity really believed the U.S. would be overrun by Mexican and Central American migrants, he would not be saying, drop the issue, have a path to citizenship. He obviously believed it was a loser for the Republicans. This was the same time that some of the Republicans issued what was called their autopsy report, where they said, we have to drop this anti-immigrant stuff. We have to move closer to the Latino population if we want to have any chance of gaining a majority of the votes at some time in the future. But Trump came in and proved Hannity and the autopsy report to be incorrect. Trump had a deeper understanding of the American white population and the resonance of racism and nativism in this country. Trump said, no, screw that. We're going to go straight out attack against non-whites, against Muslims, against Mexicans, etc. His party had already recognized that the whole thing was fake, but Trump saw something true about the way that there are elements within people, the worst, most vile, most bestial elements. They exist in every person. I mean, every major religion has noticed and talked endlessly about this fact since the beginning of human civilization. Everybody has bad, has evil within them. And Trump has a profound understanding of how to draw it out, how to mobilize it, how to weaponize it, and how to use it for political purposes. And that is now a core element of the rightist revolution that has taken power in this country and that threatens to evolve from just an incipient fascism into a new, unique American fascism. And by the way, just on a mechanical level, you ain't seen nothing yet. I mean, if the Republicans win this time, if they maintain control of both houses of Congress, and especially if they maintain many of the major governorships that are up across the country, which will enable them to further rig House districts and do even more radical voter suppression, things will get much, much worse. Trump's ability to incite at the grassroots level racist violence will go from just a few isolated incidents, which is what we have now, into the possibility of actual organized forces, paramilitaries. And up till now, the Supreme Court has been in an ambiguous way something of a check because of the ambiguous position of Kennedy. Kennedy is gone now. He's replaced by Kavanaugh, who was part of the group of rightist Republicans on the court who are radical right and Bolshevik in their discipline. Anything that the Republican Revolution wants to do, this Supreme Court will rubber stamp it. And that's new. That's new as of just X number of weeks ago. So we haven't seen anything compared to what's coming if the Republicans are able to win these elections.
I mean, Trump succeeded in doing something quite unbelievable. Last week in the middle of the night, I think it was one of his 3 a.m. tweets, he said Republicans are doing so well in early voting and at the polls, and now this, he put it in, quote, bomb stuff. This was in the midst of the letter bombs being sent.
Yeah. Trump is a sharp guy. He's an ignoramus and a fool, but he's also a sharp guy. You know, the human mind is very complex, and that's one reason why he's so dangerous. He was essentially planning the American equivalent of a series of Nuremberg rallies to close out the campaign. The Pittsburgh massacre, the Louisville massacre, although Pittsburgh got much more attention, the pipe bombs threw him off stride. If these atrocities had happened outside of election season, far from an election, it actually would have been a plus for the Trump forces and the rightist revolution. Because these are the kinds of acts that traditionally give energy to fascistic movements. They serve as movement building. They push the envelope. They create conditions of fear and chaos that increase the demand for the strong leader. But in this case, it was an inconvenience, and it really annoyed Trump. In fact, he even was forced by public opinion and his aides to issue a statement where he said, acts or threats of political violence of any kind have no place in the United States of America. Well, as any honest officer at the Pentagon will tell you, acts or threats of political violence are the core of the American-led world system. Anybody who knows politics knows that. And one of the things that Trump has done is he is starting to increase the role that those kinds of acts or threats of political violence play and potentially play in American domestic politics. I mean, we have a long history of domestic political violence, of course, against Native Americans, against African-American slaves, against the labor movement, etc., and continuing today on an ad hoc basis, encouraged by the Trump-like forces in the case of shootings of unarmed civilians, especially African-Americans, and on the border, occasional killings of immigrants. There was a young woman from Guatemala, from Quetzaltenango, who was shot in the head by the Border Patrol near Laredo, Texas, this past spring. And by the way, the logical culmination of Trump's current immigration push, as you noted earlier, which includes the idea of presidential fiat to amend the Constitution, which, by the way, could be accepted by the Kavanaugh Court. It could not have been previously, but now that's on the table. And if they accept that, that'll opens the door to a president knocking out any other part of the Constitution he doesn't like. But the logical conclusion of this push is setting up Israeli-type snipers, like the Israelis have along the Gaza border, where they pick off civilians, even pick off people who are wearing press vests, pick off medical personnel, pick off unarmed people who are just standing there protesting. If you look at Fox News and their demand, their pressure for actually opening fire on the border, that's the logical next step if the Republicans win. If the Democrats are able to to get at least one house, that will be some significant constraint on Trump's freedom of action.
There is the attack by a close U.S. ally, Saudi Arabia. The Saudi murder of the Washington Post columnist Khashoggi. Every day now we're getting out new information. Today, apparently, the Turkish authorities say they may have liquefied his body or turned it to ashes with acid after he was strangled right after he walked into the consulate in Turkey. Your thoughts, Alan?
As a result of the public outrage at the torture and murder Khashoggi, the U.S. is looking for ways to signal a pullback on its support for Saudi regime led by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. And just the other day, Pompeo came out and called for a ceasefire in Yemen. Now, in and of itself, that call is in theory a good thing. But just in September, Pompeo certified to Congress to prevent the freezing of a small amount of the arms that the U.S. was providing to attack the Yemeni civilian population. He certified that adequate steps were being taken by the Saudis and by the U.S. to protect civilians. This as they were bombing school buses, bombing funerals, bombing wedding parties, and doing it with U.S. refueling help, U.S. planes, and U.S. munitions provided by Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and others. Pompeo certified that this was okay. We'll see what happens. Right now, as he says this, Saudi forces are massing outside of Yemen's main port, some there fear for another attack on the city to try to cut off and starve the place. This as they have brought millions to the brink of famine and have already killed, by the best recent estimates, perhaps 50,000, perhaps 60 or 70,000 Yemenis, and created one of the most serious outbreaks of cholera in recent world history. This is all directly chargeable against the U.S. There's some talk about cutting off U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Well, that's not a matter of policy. That's a criminal matter. These U.S. arms sales and this U.S. refueling and training for Saudi Arabia is a war crime, because the U.S. is facilitating attacks on civilian targets in Yemen. George Bush Jr. put it very well. He said, if you arm a terrorist, you are a terrorist. I agree with Bush Jr. And in this case, the U.S. government is a terrorist. That's the way we should look at the Saudi arms sales. In terms of the murder of Khashoggi itself, the thing that strikes me about it most is that the main reason this exploded into an issue was because there's a tape of the death room, the final seconds of the victim's life. And there are so many people around the world who've been imagining what happened in that death room when their own loved one was tortured to death by any one of three dozen U.S. client states over the years. I personally have wondered about two such death rooms, one in Guatemala, where a friend of mine story was she had her hands cut off, another in Indonesia, where Jafar Siddiq Hamza, my friend, had his face sliced off by the authorities who had kidnapped him. And when we found him, his hands were bound behind his back. Imagine if there were tapes of all of those events and they were on TV every day and we were all forced to watch them. This policy wouldn't last a year. We've got to stop it. But if you want that kind of change, if you want change on something that profound, you've got to stop the dismantling of what democracy we have in this country. You've got to stop the rise of incipient fascism. And to do that tactically, you've got to go out and mobilize for the Democrats.
Johnny's in America, you tricks at the wheel. Anyone, they don't even just pretend. Jonah's an American.
I'm afraid of Americans. I'm afraid of the world. I'm afraid I can't help it. I'm afraid I can't. I'm afraid of Americans. I'm afraid of the world. I'm afraid I can't help it. I'm afraid of Americans.
Jonah's an American. junk. I'm afraid of Americans. I'm afraid of the world. I'm afraid I can't help it. I'm afraid I can't. I'm afraid of Americans. I'm afraid of the world. I'm afraid I can't help it. I'm afraid I can't. I'm afraid of Americans.
To go before the history-making midterm elections in the U.S., Public Citizen is reporting that the races that are pitting Democrats against Republicans are awash with so much cash that it's diluting our democracy. There are 14 races across the nation that are highly competitive, where outside spending is exceeding money spent by the candidates themselves. A whopping $715 million in outside spending has flooded the races, with nearly 60% of that figure focused on just 39 races. The Center for Responsive Politics has determined that this is a record-breaking amount of outside spending in any election season. Public Citizen President Robert Wiseman concluded, "This is the world Citizens United made." My guest is Alan Zibel, Research Director of the Corporate Presidency Project at Public Citizen. Welcome to the program, Alan. Let's first define what we mean by outside spending, because that's a term that, you know, if you're not paying close attention to campaign finance, you might not quite understand. How do you define it?
So what defines outside political spending is, people may have heard of super PACs is a common thing that has entered the lexicon. That means political action committees that are not bound by the traditional $5,000 contribution limit that refers to traditional, you know, in the pre-Citizens United world, PACs, political action committees. Other examples of outside money would be nonprofits, 501c4s that typically structured as 501c4s that are also allowed unlimited contributions and unlimited spending. So what we mean by outside spending, we don't think it's wrong to spend money on election, but what we object to is unlimited spending and no disclosure or limited disclosure of donations, of who the money is coming from. So the problem is it allows corporations and people with the most resources to throw the most possible amount of money, as much money as they can, into election races.
So essentially, this is very clearly the kind of thing that the Supreme Court's rulings on Citizens United unleashed, right?
Yes. Exactly. We have strongly objected to it for years, and we continue to strongly object to it. I mean, I think that as the consequences of Citizens United become more obvious, we'll see some changes. Advocated for a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United for many years. You know, in this analysis, we found that as of earlier this month, $422 million went to the tightest races, really. The races categorized by the Cook Political Report as a toss-up. And it goes to show that this outside money is going where it can have the most impact. It's flowing to the tightest possible races. And the fear is that these candidates are, you know, when they get into office, are going to be beholden to the donors that got them there. And that's really the concern. And the outside spending concern applies to Democratic candidates, and it applies to Republican candidates. It's a problem on both sides.
Does one party have more outside spending behind it than the other?
Yes. I mean, Republicans do have more outside spending than Democrats, advocating both for Republican candidates and against Democratic candidates. But when we looked at it, we found that it's not by a huge factor. It's not really a giant advantage, but it's not overwhelming.
So essentially, Democrats have decided or realized that if you can't beat them, join them, and they've played the game alongside Republicans. Can you give us some sense of the sources of these outside spending, in as much as we know? Are these individuals? Are they corporations? Or we simply don't know because the rules allow them to remain anonymous?
So some of it's disclosed, some of it's undisclosed. I mean, it's definitely corporate money, and it's definitely really wealthy individuals. When I say corporate money, it's less corporations themselves and more kind of corporate funded organizations. So you have the Kochs being a huge, huge player in this, the Koch brothers through their Americans for Prosperity network, which kind of aggregates their money with other wealthy donors. It's less the actual corporations doing the donations, but often their founders, their primary owners, their executives, that sort of thing. That applies to the Democratic side and the Republican side. I mean, I think you've seen really large individual donations. Mike Bloomberg has announced big, big multi-million dollar donations to Democrats. You've seen Stephen Schwarzman, a CEO of Blackstone Group, giving big to Republicans. I mean, it's fairly astounding, the dollars that we're talking about.
Can you give us an example of a race that is very competitive? It's hard to predict which way it's going to go, where outside spending has flooded in. Also, where that money is going, what are they spending that money on? Is it primarily television ads, mailers?
On the Senate side, there's the five races where outside spending exceeded the candidate's own spending by the largest amounts were West Virginia. So you have Manchin versus Patrick Morrisey. That was actually the biggest one. Now, that one, experts and pollsters are not expecting that one to be close, that Manchin is probably in good shape there. But McCaskill's race in Missouri is supposed to be very close, and outside spending is way exceeding candidate spending there. Out west, Rosen versus Heller in the Senate in Nevada. Got Donnelly's race in Indiana, and and you've got a really tight race in Tennessee, Marsha Blackburn versus Phil, I believe it's pronounced Bredesen. This money largely goes to TV, right? It goes to ads that, you know, are not supposed to be officially coordinated with the campaign and have some sort of official distance from the campaign, but are really echoing the same exact kind of things. You know, they'll have some sort of innocuously named group. It's all kind of a sham. I mean, I think that we pretty much agree with that. A lot of the outside spending, too, is being done by entities that are very close to the House GOP, to the House Dems, to the Senate Dems, to the House Republicans. They're not the official party committee, right? They're not the DCCC or the DSCC, but they're PACs that have been created to sort of mirror the official campaign, and often they're staffed by people who have connections to Senator Schumer or have connections to Senator McConnell. There's no official legal connection between the two, but it's kind of the same crowd, so that it's sort of this quasi-official outside spending committee that is allowing unlimited donations and unlimited expenses that, you know, we really find objectionable.
So, Alan, for those people, those voters who are living in the areas where, or the districts where these highly competitive races are taking place, where this huge amount of money is pouring in, they're basically being bombarded by ads on television, by mailers, by all of the sort of standard things that you get when you have money pouring in. Presumably, it's coming so thick and fast, there's no time to vet the claims that might be being made. This must be incredibly wearying to voters.
This is your Supreme Court that ruled that.
That took it upon themselves to rule.
Yes, and they decided that political advertising and backed by millions and hundreds of millions of dollars is the same thing as your speech and my speech.
So do you have any sense that this money is actually having an impact, right? So when you've got giant amounts of money being thrown at a race from one side, it's going to be met by nearly the same amount of money being thrown at it from the other side. And it's probably going to come down to, you know, very, very close races. But do you have any sense that this money is actually having a big impact one way or another?
Obviously, we're not going to know until Tuesday, November 6th. And how can it not have an impact? Certainly, you know, over and over seeing those ads has got to impact voters. It's got to shape your perceptions of a race and a candidate. But I would, you know, however, point out that we've seen, you know, Beto O'Rourke in Texas just raise an incredible amount of money from individuals around the country who are really inspired by his candidacy and appreciate a candidate who's raising money from ordinary people. Not an official endorsement, but there's a lot of appeal to many Americans in that argument.
How does this election compare to earlier elections in terms of outside political spending? Are we just seeing an upward trend in money?
Yeah, I think you are seeing an upward trend in money. This is going to be a record for outside spending in a midterm. It's not going to exceed outside spending in any election. That would have been the last election in 2016, because a presidential election is always going to be a larger election in terms of spending. But I probably should be a little more careful there. It would be shocking to see midterm spending exceed 2016, but it doesn't seem to be on pace to do that. What you said is true. We're seeing a huge amount of interest in this election, and we'll see what happens. I mean, the prospects for the Democrats in the House, I think Democrats are feeling okay about it. I think they're not feeling too great about the Senate right now. You know, you're seeing a lot of people be energized by politics these days. And, you know, particularly in California, you have races in long-time conservative districts in Southern California that seem like they're on the verge of potentially flipping. So there are things for a progressive to be excited about, and don't count your chickens before they hatch. But I think that, you know, people are feeling okay about it.
Alan, how does this change the way in which an individual who wants to run for Congress, wants to run for a seat, goes about doing so? Because if outside money is exceeding the money that the candidate is spending, in some cases exceeding the money that the political party is spending, doesn't that completely shift the dynamics of how one approaches running for office? That you would essentially be fundraising, not from ordinary people, not from your constituency, not from the people who are actually voting for you, but you would be fundraising from these political action committees.
Yeah, I would say that that's very concerning, but we also have a parallel trend of the Beto O'Rourke's of the world that are just raising an incredible amount from individuals. So not every candidate's going to have that guy's kind of magnetism and charisma, so it's a challenge.
What can ordinary people do using these numbers? Because yes, overturning Citizens United is a very critical thing to do, but say that someone lives in one of these constituencies, one of these districts where there's ridiculous amounts of money being spent. Can they use data from your report to alert and to just raise awareness among voters about how their votes matter less and less for every dollar that these outside groups are spending?
Absolutely. You know, we're happy to be a resource, and that's, you know, kind of why we're putting this stuff out there by district, is to really educate people in those individual communities. So if you go on citizen.org, you can check into our research and look at races in your area.
And can they then sort of use that data to also hold those candidates running for office, right? Say, you know, look at all this money that's being spent on your behalf by these outside groups. We don't like this. We're highly uncomfortable with this. We demand independence, etc.
Absolutely. No, that's a great idea.
I mean, of course, the candidates would likely say, well, I have nothing to do with this. These are outside groups that can spend any which way they want. And is that a sort of advantage that Citizens United gives to these PACs and to the candidates and to the political parties, who can sort of claim distance, even if there isn't any?
Right. It's sort of plausible deniability. It's not, mm-hmm. kind of knows it's nonsense, but then you have that deniability factor in there. So yes, yeah. No, that's a concern.
Give out a website where people can get access to the report again, Ellen?
Oh, sure. www.citizen.org.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
I got so much trouble on my mind. Refuse to lose. Uh-huh.
As a man thinking, it becomes his reality. I used to let stress build up until I learned that stress will eat your insides up like worms. See, worry is the cousin of death. Thinking negative, you might as well go ahead and bury yourself. I was taught by the struggles of life to be strong like iron. You got to have the heart of a lion. I've been through my share of this hell, but still I rise. Many days didn't know what to do, but we survive. Every struggle is a test, a lesson. You just gotta figure out how to overcome and catch the blessing. They want us to turn to dope and lose all hope. Spirit broke and confused, but I refuse to lose. Through fear, through pain, through loss, I can't stop, won't stop till we make it to the tip top. This is hip hop.
I got so much trouble on my mind. Refuse to lose. Refuse to lose. I got so much trouble on my mind.
It's a death sentence. You can't survive without no food. That ain't no sustenance. Plus when it's crunch time, back on the wall, life on the line. Before you lose your balance and fall, you will find that it's an instinct. Act first and then think. Second law of nature, self-preservation. Move without reservation. No hesitation when it comes to me and mine. Do you come from that designer? Do your compass need alignment? A mercenary, my assignment. Kill or be killed, a sinner of skill. However you define it, I shall see him pray Victoria. Revolutionary propaganda intended to raise warriors. Ain't nothing like this world crisis. The price of life is measured by the lifeless. It's brutal, but I fight this. Supply, demand, inflation rises. We can't afford the rice. It's no food to eat. I know it's hard to digest.
I got so much trouble on my mind. Refuse to lose. Refuse to lose. I got so much trouble on my mind.
The gold mine, overtime grind with no days off, but ain't nothing like the feeling when it all pays off. All it takes is a thought of my son for motivation. Long as I'm alive, you can't break my dedication. Family first, everything real in the field. It's a cold game, like don't give a fuck how you feel. We live in a material world, or so it seems, but I ain't got nothing to lose but bad dreams. When I woke up, I was already 17, but I was determined to break the cycles I seen. When I learned that the blood in my veins from kings that curdle when I looked at the present day scene. But the same pressure that turned my brother to a fiend, I face it, embrace it, and convert it into steam.
I got so much trouble on my mind.
Christopher R. Browning, it's my very good pleasure to welcome you to our radio program.
Thank you very much.
We reached out to you after we read your article, The Suffocation of Democracy, and this was in response of, I guess you've just been flooded with questions from people asking about comparisons between our political moment right now in the United States and the political moment that ranged, I guess, in Europe and in particularly Germany between the two great wars, World War I and World War II.
Yes, certainly the interwar period was a period when democracy was very much under siege and many democratic regimes collapsed, and some of them were transformed into totalitarian dictatorships, particularly Nazi Germany. So I was often asked, to what degree do events these days resemble those? And I found some of the discussion where people very carelessly, I think, made simplistic comparisons, and there is much to be learned from the interwar period, so I didn't want that to be obscured by the kind of counterproductive equivalencies that didn't have nuance or didn't make distinctions, that didn't look at both similarities and differences.
So there are similarities, but this isn't Nazi Germany that we're living through right now.
Yeah, certainly what I was arguing in the article is Trump is not Hitler, Trumpism is not Nazism, but that nonetheless democracy is very much under stress, and we cannot fail to take seriously the dangers to democracy, not just in the U.S., but the trends that are at loose in the world today and other parts of the world as well.
What are the similarities that you think about most?
Certainly the fall of Weimar was in part a political system that became increasingly dysfunctional by paralysis, by gridlock, by polarization. In that situation, Hitler created a coalition of discontent with a great deal of demagoguery, a great deal of scapegoating. Nonetheless, never gained a majority vote in Germany. Nazis maximized at 37% in the summer of 1932, but comes to power through an alliance with the old conservative national elites, we might call the establishment. It is Hindenburg and people around him that want to carry out a conservative turn in German politics, don't have the popular support to do it, ally with Hitler under the illusion that they can use Hitler to carry out a major revision or conservative revolution that they can control. They bring him into power, and of course he uses them. They don't use him. They are gratified by their initial agenda that they fulfill, but then it turns out that they're deluded in thinking that they can continue to control Hitler, that they are suckered into an arrangement in which he is the chief beneficiary.
You write that if future historians look and talk about the fall of American democracy, the grave digger would be Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader.
Yes, I think he has contributed perhaps the most to the dysfunction of our current system. That is, he committed himself to the failure of the Obama presidency and did everything within his power to make it unsuccessful. That, of course, culminated first in the slowing down of appointments of judges to the point that the Democrats, you know, changed the rules on the filibuster for judicial appointments other than the Supreme Court. And then, of course, I think more seriously, when he blocked the Merrick Garland nomination in Barack Obama's second term and left over 100 vacancies when he wouldn't give hearings to all sorts of other Obama judicial appointments as well. So that when Trump came in, they had both the Supreme Court seat and 100 other judicial vacancies ready and waiting. And then, of course, he himself then threw out the filibuster for Supreme Court judges in order to get Neil Gorsuch nominated. And that all of this, I think, has broken the norms whereby everybody recognized, however important they were, you had to do at least something to keep the judiciary from being fully politicized. Clearly, it was a political process, but that certain limits had to be accepted. And I think Mitch McConnell has just torn all the limits away and has turned the judiciary into a spoil system. If you have the power to do it, you appoint. And if you have the power to block, you block. And that we now henceforth will live under the McConnell rules. And then if the Senate and the president are in opposition, you will have no appointments, certainly not at the upper level. And when they're in alignment, you will have a rush to fill those seats like you would be filling, you know, any kind of position in a kind of spoil system. So I think it's a very fateful demise of the checks and balances between the three branches of government, basically rendering the judiciary into a kind of lifetime appointment of House of Lords that is left behind when administrations are ousted to try to block whatever the successor administration might be. So I think this is a very fateful turn. Even if Trump is defeated in 2020, the legacy will be a court that will obstruct any Democratic measure for the, you know, decades to come. Once you've done that, you basically sort of said the Democratic system can't work. And once you lose faith in that, the doors are open.
Take that along with what we've seen with redistricting, what we, you know, usually call gerrymandering, voter suppression, to the Electoral College, to all of these things. And I get the sense, as we are seeing a changing country demographically, politically, that the Republican Party right now is trying to set up our political institutions to ensure that they have some considerable sway and control, even as the country changes here in the immediate future.
Their great fear is that demographically history is going against them, and so they are trying to build the bulwarks against that. And they can only do that by enshrining minority rule. So the Constitution, in a sense, already tilts the playing field under our current demography, in the sense that small states and less populated states are currently more Republican. Democratic votes are concentrated in big cities and big states. So, of course, the Senate overrepresents more thinly populated areas, which are currently more often Republican. And, of course, the Electoral College does, too. I think it's no accident that in the last five presidential elections, the Democrats have had the popular vote four times, but have only elected the president twice. That happened very occasionally in the previous 180 years of American history. Now it's happened twice in the last 16 years. So that, I think, is alarming. And then, as you say, when you add on to that, gerrymandering carried out now with the capacity of computers. So you can fine-tune gerrymandering in a way that was utterly impossible previously. And you add to that systematic voter repression or suppression, so that increasingly you can target with surgical precision the groups that you want to disenfranchise. And then you add in the unlimited spending that is possible with the Citizens United decision and the doing away with any kind of limits on campaign financing. The mixture of money, voter suppression, gerrymandering, already on top of the overweighting of small states and more rural states vis-a-vis big cities and big states, is what gives, I think, Republicans the hope that they can, in fact, build a kind of wall that will permanently prevent the demographic changes of a growing minority from eventually sweeping away a Republican Party basically on a earlier demography that was dominated, of course, by whites and above all by white males.
How would you compare issues around propaganda today to what we'd see with the rise of fascism?
Certainly in the regime, say, of Hitler and Mussolini, there was a determination to control the press. So you had very strict censorship. You even had a ministry of people's enlightenment and propaganda in the Third Reich under Joseph Goebbels, whose task it was to manage sort of all the media so that the production of movies and popular entertainment, as well as news, would all be controlled and directed by the government. Again, a major difference now is the fact that the new authoritarianism, if I call it that, understands that you don't have to have strict censorship. You don't have to abolish the free press. You can simply so contaminate and flood the world with alternative facts, with contested information, with serial lies, that you've so polluted the sources of information out there that people sort of throw up their hands and give up in trying to figure out what's happening. You create a world in which, in a sense, there is no foundation of fact, or at least no belief in a foundation of fact other than what confirms what you want to know or what complies with your previous political loyalties. Again, very different, say, than in the 1930 dictatorships. We aren't closing down newspapers. We aren't having a official ministry of propaganda that is controlling the media. But in reality, even though the media has become quite critical of Trump, there's no political penalty for him to be a serial liar whatsoever. You can publish all of the fact checks you want. You can run article after article that basically say claims he's made are not true. And it strengthens him with his base. He just says that the media is out to get him, gives a kind of common enemy that excites the base. And he's realized you don't have to abolish a free press. You just make it irrelevant.
You mentioned in your article for the New York Review of Book, Fox News, and in particular, Sean Hannity. Do you ever watch Sean Hannity show?
Occasionally, just check in on what's happening.
Me too. Me too. It's intense.
I can't take a lot of it. So it's in small doses. I would kind of look at it as Fox as being kind of the privatization of what in previous regimes had been a ministry of propaganda. You don't have to have a government agency. It's now a private one. And the symbiosis between Fox News and Trump, of course, is very close. He watches them to get his ideas. Hannity calls him at night. They chat. And then they back in their shows what he's doing. It's a two-way street, and they are joined at the hip. Certainly in terms of who has access to and who Trump listens to, he is a very key figure.
What you saw in the rise of the Nazis, what you saw was sometimes, I guess we call it an unholy alliance between the communists and the right-wing paramilitary groups in battling the democratic socialists who were in control at the time.
The communists and the Nazis fought each other, but they both agreed that they were against the socialists. And the communists basically referred to the social democrats as, quote, red fascists. And in their own delusion, thought Hitler was just temporary. The social democrats were the long-term threat and rival for working class loyalty, and therefore had to be the number one target, the number one enemy, not Hitler and the Nazis, who they dismissed as peripheral and temporary. One historian wrote, the history of Adolf Hitler is the history of his underestimation. And we certainly have underestimated Trump as well. I think in that sense, one, we can't underestimate Trump. And two, we have to take a broad popular front approach if we are going to have an alternative. What happens thereafter, of course, we still face real difficulties. I mean, how is one going to reverse the growing disparity in income in the United States? How is one going to recreate a more viable labor union movement that can create a social contract that will share increases in productivity and wealth and not have 95% of that go to a very narrow band of the American population? How are you going to overcome and heal the divisions we have now in class and race and gender and sexual orientation that he's fostered? I mean, basically, Trump has played the division card all along. And above all, of course, what are we going to do about climate change? I mean, the clock is ticking so close on that. All of this, we might survive, but we're going to inherit a unsustainable earth by the time all of this clears up. So the question you raise, what follows, is to my mind a very scary one, because a lot of these things have very intractable problems that we're being prevented from dealing with because we're focusing on holding Trump back, not about solving really basic problems. We haven't even got to the point of solving those problems.
Vietnam vet with a cardboard sign sitting there by the left turn line, a flag on his wheelchair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him. The VA budget's just stretched so thin, and there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. That big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills. But they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore. You see those pallets piled up on the loading dock? They're just gonna sit there till they rot. Cause there's nothing to ship, nothing to pack. Just busted concrete and rusted tracks. Empty storefronts around the square. There's a needle in the gutter and glass everywhere. You don't come down here unless you're looking to score. We can't make it here anymore. The bar's still open, but man, it's slow. The tip jar's light and the register bartender don't have much to say. The regular crowd gets thinner each day. Some have maxed out all their credit cards. Some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage won't pay for a roof, won't pay for a drink. If you gotta have proof, distract yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far 5:15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here anymore. To pay less tax, the working poor get to fall through the cracks. So let them eat jelly beans, let them eat cake, let them eat ish, whatever it takes. They can join the Air Force or join the Corps if they can't make it here anymore. What we got, and if the president wants to admit it or not, you can read it in the paper, read it on the wall, hear it on the wind if you're listening at all. Get out of that limo, look us in the eye, call us on a cell phone, tell us all why. In Dayton, Ohio, or Portland, Maine, or a cotton gin out on the great high plains, it's done closed down along with the school and the hospital and the swimming pool. Dust devils dance in the noonday heat. There's rats in the alley and trash in the street. Gang graffiti on a boxcar door. We can't make it here anymore. Thank you.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
I'm down in the basement, making signs out of love. And there's a big time special guest tonight, coming in from above. This town hasn't seen such excitement since John Cena back in 09. That arena is known for its wrestling matches, but tonight we're gonna have ourselves a different kind of good time. And I'm gonna take my mama and her sister Anne Marie, and I hope I'll find a like-minded girl tonight at the Trump rally. Well, I'm gonna take a shower and shave so I look good. Wear my Hillary for prison shirt like a good boy should. Gonna show up there early, watch the motorcade arrive. Gonna grill up some meat in the parking lot. They say the doors will open at 5. Yeah, the doors will open at 5. Got my picture of Obama, which will burn in effigy. But I hope I'll find a like-minded girl tonight at the Trump rally. Maybe I'll get you sit behind the man they love to hate and watch him profit about problems I can't contemplate. Oh, sometimes he scares me when he goes on one of those rants. Sometimes I don't know what he's talking about, but it makes them liberals their pants. Oh, it makes them their pants. Oh, it gives them such trauma, and it makes us so happy. Oh, I just wanna find a like-minded girl. Oh, I really wanna find a like-minded girl. Yes, I just wanna find a like-minded girl tonight at the Trump rally.
On Saturday in Pittsburgh at the Tree of Life Synagogue, a mass shooter murdered 11 worshipers. It was the worst act of violence against Jewish people in U.S. history.
Bang, bang, bang. And then bang, 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 bang.
The rabbi pushed us into a storeroom. The door opens and the shooter walked in. Afraid that the next shot I hear will be a bullet in my back. I was more afraid than any other time in my life.
We were still holding our prayer books and wearing our prayer shawls.
And I'm hearing people screaming, and it's seared in my brain. I can't erase that tape.
Naturally, in times like these, our nation looks to its president for comfort and guidance. That's our first mistake. Immediately after the shooting, Trump told reporters how the attack in Pittsburgh could have been prevented. Spoiler alert, it's more guns.
This is a case where if they had an armed guard inside, they might have been able to stop him immediately.
Yes, it's so simple. In fact, why didn't the Jewish people have an armed guard for the last 5,000 years? Moses could have saved a lot of time walking in the desert if Pharaoh knew he was packing. You know what I mean? Okay, back up, Pharaoh.
Now, some people thought Trump should cancel his rally that he had planned for Saturday night, but he explained why he didn't cancel the rally at the rally he should have canceled.
Dick Grasso, a friend of mine, great guy, he headed up the New York Stock Exchange on September 11th, and the New York Stock Exchange was open the following day. He said, and what they had to do to open it, you wouldn't believe. We won't even talk to you about it. But he got that exchange open.
That is an inspiring story, if any of it was true. Because the New York Stock Exchange was closed until September 17th. So Trump's instinct when addressing a tragedy was to lie about another tragedy. But there was something that almost prevented Trump from holding his rally.
By the way, somebody just said, your hair looks different today. I said, well, I was standing under the wing of Air Force One doing a news conference early this morning, a very unfortunate news conference, and the wind was blowing and the rain, and I was soaking wet, and that's what I ended up with today. And I said, well, at least you know it's mine. I said, maybe I should cancel this arrangement because I have a bad hair day.
Well, Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto joins us now. Do you want the president to come tomorrow, sir?
I would prefer if he would wait until we've had the opportunity to have all of the funerals.
The White House, at least at a staff level, very much aware of the resistance in the community to the president's visit today.
Yeah, and I'm sure the president is aware of that as well. It's a huge embarrassment for the president of the United States to be going to Pittsburgh this afternoon and to not be greeted by the mayor, to not be greeted by the governor, to not be greeted by the key local officials who are attending to this tragedy in their own city.
And you guys report that they were all invited.
They were invited. And I think the White House wanted them to be there to greet the president. It's important to the president, this president in particular, that he be greeted with respect. He made such a big deal about President Obama going overseas when sometimes the red carpet wasn't rolled out for him. He's now going to Pittsburgh without any carpet at all.
And it looks like his daughter and son-in-law have had to override his circuitry to get him to deliver a statement at all on Saturday. And moments later, hours later, he was back behind the podium at a MAGA rally, trashing a lot of the people who received pipe bombs in the mail last week.
Of course, the tragedy this weekend makes the serial bomber last week seems like a lighthearted story from the Smile File. The FBI caught that guy who did it, Florida maniac Cesar Sayak. This alleged criminal was arrested on Friday morning at an AutoZone car parts shop in Florida.
All the mail bomb targets, and there were 14 as of Friday, had one thing in common. They have been frequent, repeated targets of attack by the President of the United States on Twitter and at his constant political rallies.
Maxine Waters, that's a real beauty.
A very dishonest person, crooked Hillary Clinton.
ISIS is honoring President Obama. He is the founder of ISIS.
Cory Booker, he destroyed what he did. He was so bad.
We call him 1% Biden until Obama took him off the trash heap. He couldn't do anything. Now he's talking about Ron. Tough guy.
CNN's the worst.
Do you ever see when the fake news interviews him and then they try and cut it, but they'll go to a person holding a sign who gets paid by Soros or somebody.
Holder went after Christians. He went after our great evangelicals. He went after the Tea Party people. You know that?
Well, I think Brennan's a very bad guy. And if you look at it, a lot of things happened under his watch. I think he's a very bad person.
President Obama, along with Brennan and Clapper and the whole group that you see on television now, probably getting paid a lot of money by your networks.
Here's what we know about Sayak so far. He's 56 years old. And in the past, he's worked as a DJ and spent much of the past decade living out of his van. There's no way to know for sure if Sayak was a fan of President Trump unless you see him at a Trump rally or posing in a MAGA hat in front of Trump's bus. Or check out his van, which features the world's most MAGA-tastic fan art collage. He might as well have had a bumper sticker that said, if this van's a rockin', it's because I'm making pipe bombs to send to the people pictured on the side of the van. Now, with Sayak's adoration of Trump and the fact that everyone Sayak sent a bomb to was someone that Trump had targeted in his speeches, it's reasonable to ask if the president's racist fear-mongering and declaring so-called enemies of the people in any way encourages violence toward the people he calls enemies. Reporters asked if the president bears any of that responsibility, and here's what Sarah Huckstan said.
The only person responsible for carrying out either of these heinous acts were the individuals who carried them out.
And the president agrees. There's only one place to put the blame.
The fake news media, the true enemy of the people, must stop the open and obvious hostility and report the news accurately and fairly. That will do much to put out the flame, dot, 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 of anger and outrage. And we will then be able to bring all sides together in peace and harmony. Fake news must end. Nothing, okay, the point is, nothing I say influences anyone. But if the news keeps influencing people by saying what I said, I'm just going to say, I told you so.
We were talking about Pittsburgh. We're talking about the mail bombs. What we haven't talked about as much is what happened in Kentucky and that what investigators are looking into down there. A white man who killed two African-Americans in a Kroger, a grocery store that's being looked at as a potential hate crime.
Gregory Bush was captured on a surveillance camera trying to force open the doors of the First Baptist Church of Jeffersontown for several minutes Wednesday before turning his attention instead to the nearby supermarket where he killed Maurice Stallard and Vicki Lee Jones. Armed bystander Ed Harrell confronted Bush in the parking lot outside the grocery store after the killings. This is Harrell's son Steve Zininger speaking with a local NBC affiliate.
So your dad was confronting the shooter?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did that man say anything, or how did your dad figure out something wasn't right?
He didn't realize it was him till he'd already seen the gun by his side. He said, "Don't shoot me. I won't shoot you." He's like, "Whites don't kill whites."
Whites don't kill whites, Gregory Bush said.
What demonstrable change have you seen in the past year and a half, 2 years?
Well, you know, we've seen a real surge, as I said before, in hate groups. In the immediate aftermath of Mr. Trump's election, we saw a big increase in the number of hate incidents around the country. And sadly, about 40% of them bore Mr. Trump's signature. And what I mean by that is they used his slogan, they used his name, or they used his words about women. And so I don't think there's any question but that there's been a fraying of social norms since Mr. Trump's candidacy.
One bit of Trump rhetoric that has really riled the right lately has been the immigrant caravan that Trump and his friends falsely claim is funded by Jewish billionaire George Soros. The bomber, says Osayak, appeared to be obsessed with Soros, mentioning him dozens of times on one of his Twitter accounts. And the Pittsburgh shooter also reposted several viral comments on a since deactivated social media account about the migrant caravan. One post described the Third World Caravan as a group of approaching invaders. Now, if you're wondering where two fringe lunatics could latch onto the same racist conspiracy theory, I'll give you a hint. It's Fox News.
It's a highly organized, very elaborate, sophisticated operation. I have that from the highest levels of the Guatemalan government. They're investigating those groups criminally, and I strongly urge President Trump and Attorney General Sessions to do the same here. A lot of these folks also have affiliates who are getting money from the Soros-occupied State Department, and that is a very great concern.
Really? The Soros-occupied State Department? It's barely the Pompeo-occupied State Department. But no one understands this caravan issue better than that which was once Lou Dobbs. He even speaks the language.
Our top story tonight, the caravan of mostly Central American immigrants is now in the Mexican city of Oaxaca tonight.
Trump just lies freely. He imbibes conspiracy theories from media outlets like Fox News, and then he spews them to his supporters. For example, after mail bombs were sent to a dozen targets of Trump's rhetoric, including leading Democrats and CNN, prominent conservatives on Twitter and Fox News began floating the theory that the bombs were a so-called false flag meant to help Democrats in the midterm.
Fox Business Network host Lou Dobbs sent out this tweet writing, "Fake news, fake bombs, who could possibly benefit by so much fakery?"
We cannot rule out that it's a false flag operation.
I feel these are a false flag bombing.
We have the worst right-wing bomb maker in history, or we have a false flag operation.
The fact that these bombs have not gone off is a great indication that I feel these are a false flag bombing.
At the risk of sounding like a far right-wing lunatic, I have to say that I believe that this whole thing was an elaborate hoax.
Of course, the other one is that false flag, and there could be someone in there, some Democrat, that, you know, low-level person, I'm not suggesting anyone on the top, but who just decided, you know what, I'm going to put this out because 2 weeks before a major election, who's going to be look like the bad guy here? The Republicans.
Fascinating.
No! It's not fascinating. It's dangerous. Someone just floated an insane conspiracy theory on a channel watched by millions of people, and you're reacting like Spock after a transporter malfunction.
Fascinating.
Now, Geraldo Rivera, who claimed the bomb's a hoax, did take it back after an arrest was made, tweeting, "Never mind, outsmarted myself in conjuring false flag operation designed to hurt Donald Trump and GOP." That's how dumb Geraldo is. He got outsmarted by Geraldo.
Even after the suspect's motivations were clear, some Trump supporters remained insistent that there was more to this story.
Barack Obama probably sent his to himself, and Hillary Clinton probably sent hers to herself.
So you don't think this guy actually sent these bombs to these officials?
No, probably not.
Why?
They probably had it done. They may have paid him to do it.
What would be the upside of that?
Trying to bring people feeling over to their side.
And against Trump.
Yeah.
Okay, I got it. So Obama flew to Florida, mailed a bomb to himself in Washington, then flew back just in time to avoid it, all to frame this guy. Now, I'm not saying that man's theory doesn't have any holes in it, but at least we can all agree he really outsmarted Geraldo Rivera.
And then there's Lou Dobbs, the Fox business host who tweeted fake news, fake bombs. Dobbs might be the most unhinged conspiracy theorist on Fox, which is saying a lot, given that Fox also employs this guy. Sean Hannity is what you get if you gave Frankenstein the brain of Alex Jones. Dobbs was one of many prominent conservatives on TV and social media spreading baseless conspiracy theories. And even before the suspect was identified, he was on TV blaming Democrats for violence against Republicans. Although watch as he tries to get through this segment, has trouble reading, and just gives up.
Be sure to vote in our poll tonight. Do you believe it's time for Democratic leaders to denounce acts of violence against Republicans as President Trump targeted Democrats. Cast your vote on Twitter at Lou Dobbs.
So this is what the president is consuming all day and then turning around and spewing to his audience. In fact, just hours before an arrest was made in the bombings on Friday, Trump went on Twitter to again attack CNN, which just days earlier had been the target of a mail bomb.
Funny how lowly rated CNN and others can criticize me at will, even blaming me for the current spate of bombs and ridiculously comparing this to September 11th and the Oklahoma City bombing. Yet when I criticize them, they go wild and scream, it's just not presidential.
That's because it's their job to cover you. Your job is to be president. They're two different jobs. You're like a guy who goes in for a checkup and says, funny how the doctor can check my prostate. But if I try to check his, I get arrested.
The president was asked this weekend if in the wake of the bomb scare directed specifically at his political opponents and CNN, he plans to pull back on all the media bashing.
Well, I think I've been toned down. You want to know the truth? I could really tone it up because, as you know, the media has been extremely unfair to me and to the Republican Party.
Yeah, if you guys stop saying mean things about me, I'll stop inciting angry lunatics to kill you. Deal? Trump also lashed out via Twitter, blaming the media for the recent violence. It's like when a bully punches you with your own fist and says, stop hitting yourself. He wrote, the fake news media is the true enemy of the people. Literally days after the media got sent pipe bombs, he calls the media the enemy of the people. He can't help himself. He has to double down. And all. It's no wonder he bankrupted all those casinos. He doesn't know how to gamble.
Shouldn't you reserve the term enemy for people who are actually the enemy of the United States rather than journalists?
The president's not referencing all media. He's talking about the growing amount of fake news that exists in the country, and the president's calling that out.
May I ask a follow-up?
Sure.
May I ask a follow-up, please? Since you mentioned that, the president said this morning the fake news media, the true enemy of the people, must stop the open and obvious hostility and report the news accurately and fairly. Can you state for the record which outlets that you and the president regard as the enemy of the people?
I'm not going to walk through a list, but I think those individuals probably know who they are.
Would that include my outlet, which received the bomb?
I don't think it's necessarily specific to a general broad generalization of a full outlet. At times, I think there's individuals that the president would be referencing. Jordan.
You're not going to state for the record then. I mean, if the president is going to say the fake news media are the enemy of the people, and if you're going to stand there and continue to say that there are some journalists, some news outlets in this country that meet that characterization, shouldn't you have the guts Sarah, to state which outlets, which journalists are the enemy of the people?
Well, I think it's irresponsible of a news organization like yours to blame responsibility of a pipe bomb that was not sent by the president, not just blame the president, but blame members of his administration for those heinous acts. I think that is outrageous, and I think it's irresponsible.
Here are the facts about hate crimes that are rising in the Trump era. FBI data revealing they've rose beginning the day Trump was elected, basically the day after. We saw white supremacists marching in Charlottesville. And this is the reporting around the country.
The NYPD investigating yet another bias crime, this time searching for the person who scrawls swastikas on phone booths along Manhattan's west side.
A Muslim American student says she was targeted because of her faith. A man came up from out of the blue, yanked on her hijab, choking her.
Parents are raising concerns after what appears to be Nazi propaganda sent to printers around the UC Berkeley campus.
The Carrollton couple woke up yesterday to find their gay pride flag torn down and vandalized.
Last night, the president stoked fears of the migrant caravan from Central America by claiming, quote, criminals and unknown Middle Easterners are mixed in. The president later admitted there is no proof of this claim. Yesterday, the Defense Department announced that 5,200 active duty troops, not reservists, active duty troops would deploy to the border with Mexico. That is substantially more manpower than we have currently fighting in Syria.
We just got breaking news this morning. According to Axios, what the president is talking about doing, he hasn't done it yet, it's one of these things where he's musing, he will do it because he wants us to talk about it, is to do away with birthright citizenship. That's the idea that if you were born in the United States, you are a citizen of the United States. Let me read you what the 14th Amendment says about this. The 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution says, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside.
You're a Harvard lawyer, and as well as being a columnist, a journalist, and editorial writer. At this stage, there's no dispute that this would become a legal fight all the way up to the Supreme Court. And I dare say that even this Supreme Court would not have to wrestle with this.
One would think. The president said a number of things in the clip you played earlier that simply are not correct. That it's ridiculous that we have this rule. It's not ridiculous that we have this rule. This rule is in the Constitution. It is, in fact, the United States is not the only country that has birthright citizenship. Many other countries have birthright citizenship. It is not, he said it's clear you can do this by legislation. It is not clear you can do this by legislation. I'm going to indulge me for 1 second. This is from 1995, Walter Dellinger, Assistant Attorney General. And this is the continuing policy, by the way, of the Department of Justice, unless it's been secretly revoked.
He became a Solicitor General
as well,
arguing in front of the Supreme Court.
This was in response to earlier proposals to have legislation to cancel birthright citizenship. My office grapples with many difficult and close issues of constitutional law. The lawfulness of this bill is not among them. This legislation is unquestionably unconstitutional.
Well, however we got here, we're here, and where we are is at an unprecedented place in American history. We have never had a president of the United States do what this president is doing. He is stoking a cold civil war in this country, and it has turned hot on the periphery. This man, Bowers, what he said was when he went in, he said, I can't sit by and watch my people get slaughtered. Screw the optics, I'm going in. And he went in to kill Jews. The Jews he believed that were financing the caravan, the invading army, like a panzer division that is threatening the southern border, an army that is racked and riddled with disease. The same type of rhetoric, the same type of propaganda that you would have seen in Germany in 1938, the dehumanization, turning people into infested vermin. What Trump is doing is stoking and inciting, for the purposes of political power, the worst amongst us to take action in his name. We have a situation where, but by for the grace of God, the largest mass assassination attempt in American history was avoided that targeted, amongst them, two former presidents of the United States. Every one of those people was a target of Donald Trump's. And this man, a fanatic, was radicalized by Fox News, by talk radio, by a right-wing propaganda machine that is as sophisticated as it has turned deadly.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
I'm Berkeley Kid. In this episode, the non-destructive device company, Better Bad Pipe Bombs.
I'd hate to get a non-explosive pipe bomb in the mail.
Well, what's the point of a non-explosive pipe bomb?
Modern warfare has evolved. Parody has been weaponized.
Can you identify this?
It's a drawing. A pencil drawing of a man smoking a pipe bomb.
The fuse is lit.
This is not a pipe bomb.
Parody is protected free speech, dude.
I'm not buying it.
Is the Boomer Bomber an installation artist?
Creative non-destructive explosive device performance art is edgy, dude.
The Boomer Bomber is a very funny terrorist.
Do you think it is funny to send a drawing of a man smoking a pipe bomb with a lit fuse and a cream pie?
I do. The Boomer Bomber is a terrible bomb designer.
Satirical joke bombs aren't real. Satirical bomb attacks only explode in your mind. There is no property damage.
Oh, great.
Keep talking.
Well, I never get the joke. It can be so frustrating.
Modern psychological warfare is old business.
We never get to old business. New business is always better. How did Ivanka get into the building?
If we have time, I will issue a report.
But we never have time. It's always the same old business.
Caller on line one.
Go ahead, caller.
The non-bombing bomber and the non-bomb bomb that was left in multiple iterations of this non-bombing hoax bomb, false bomb, fake bomb event.
God, that this was just a bad, bad comic joke at, I guess, a joke, because we don't even know the punchline.
We don't know why it was done. There was no message made, no statements made, no nothing. And in the meantime, nobody's buying it.
The voice is Lionel Nation. Are there any announcements?
Oh, yes. I just want to thank the organizers of this year's town hall meeting for making it a fun and brutal meeting. I laughed, I cried.
Was there any business accomplished?
Guns and Butter was canceled. What do you think, Ivanka?
I never liked that program. Daddy listened to it on WBAI, you know, opposition research. It was canceled for being biased against fake progressive lying bastards like you. Oh, we didn't kill anyone. Non-destructive pipe bomb parody art doesn't kill people.
Well, it was just a joke to frighten the swamp dwellers. Senator Feinstein is a collector of parody pipe bomb art.
I know the sense of helplessness that people feel. I know the urge to arm yourself, because that's what I did. I was trained in firearms. I carried a concealed weapon. I made the determination that if somebody was going to try to take me out, I was going to take them with me.
Maybe the time has come to say, I have a psychopathology, probably as a true manic depressive in a clinical sense.
I have an AR-15 and I take good care of it. But when you have the grievance killer, when you have the mental case, you realize that police have had to break into gun stores to get weapons. I was the target. They put a bomb at my home, and the bomb didn't detonate. I was very lucky. Shot out all the windows of my home. I think it remains a real threat. I do not believe it has gone away. It's the only way I think we're going to stop this. It's legal to hunt humans.
And now, back to our story.
Did you or did you not suppress the vote count?
Well, it's perfectly legal to suppress the vote. It's called governance.
Voter suppression, plain and simple.
Fact check. Is voter suppression legal?
Private organizations are free to conduct elections according to any rules they freely choose as enumerated in the organization's bylaws, including, but not limited to, vote rigging.
It's the law.
If I could vote you off the board, I would. But I can't.
Why not?
My vote is suppressed. The election supervisor hates me.
Every member who donates $25 is supposed to get a ballot.
My favorite anti-war program was canceled.
I don't make the rules. I execute them. Selectively.
Are you the election supervisor?
I'm the assistant supervisor.
Who made you the assistant election supervisor?
Why does this keep happening?
It's in the bylaws.
It's voter suppression. Plain and simple.
How do you get away with this?
Well, the votes are counted electronically.
In a foreign country?
Canada is not a foreign country.
We used to count the votes by hand.
That's too much arithmetic. There's a company in Minnesota that counts votes electronically, untouched by human hands.
Can you prove that disgruntled listeners are not being disenfranchised?
Which disgruntled voters are you referring to?
The Guns and Butter fans, like me. I'm not getting a ballot this year because the cutoff date for eligibility to vote was scheduled just before the fund drive when Guns and Butter was canceled. None of us will receive a ballot this year. That suppresses the vote count.
But why?
To advance the official narrative and suppress radical viewpoints.
Guns and Butter challenged the official story.
Can you be more specific?
I can. The California Democratic Party, the same people who stole the primary from Bernie, the same people who refused to call for Julian Assange's freedom, the entrenched, fake, progressive wing of the Democratic Party. They take big bucks from corporations, including Barbara Lee, who's a Democratic Party team player, the Corporate Contributions Party, and I'm tired of it.
Is Barbara Lee on the take?
I'm in love with Barbara Lee. How could she do that to me? Barbara, dear, if you are listening, it's me, swing voter. Please stop taking money from Nancy Pelosi and her big pharma friends. You know where that money comes from.
They want to destroy community radio.
I didn't destroy anything.
Not even a little bit.
Pacifica Radio has shifted to the right.
How do you measure that?
One station at a time. Private non-profit organizations like this one have the right to rig their own elections. It's the law.
The membership will block you.
Rescue Pacifica! Rescue Pacifica!
I have a tweet here that says the CIA is secretly running intelligence agents for Congress in the 2018 midterms.
Why is no one talking about this?
Which CIA candidates running for Congress are favored to win?
I want a straight answer.
I'm going to rule against that.
On what grounds?
Undercover agents do not reveal their methods and procedures when bringing democracy and peace to the world by secretly running for Congress in the midterm elections.
Roll the clip.
Intelligence agents running for office isn't anything new. George Bush Sr. was a CIA agent and even later served as the director of the CIA before riding Reagan's coattails into the White House. And of course, as we all know, Bush, after becoming vice president, weeks after Reagan was sworn in, a friend of the Bushes tried to assassinate him, which would have given the ruling class the president they really wanted, the ex-CIA director, George Bush. So forgive me if I'm a little bit suspicious of CIA operatives running for office, which there seems to be an awful lot of in the 2018 midterm elections. One quarter of the candidates running of the 102 districts that the DNC feel they have a fighting chance are intelligence agency operatives. So to put this into perspective, out of all the candidates running, 57 have military intelligence or State Department or NSC backgrounds. Military intelligence candidates account for 10 of the 22 districts selected for the most high-profile attention as part of the Red to Blue program. So nearly half of the candidates the DNC will be throwing money at are deep state spies. So there you have it. Maybe that's why the DNC is always able to evade prosecution or even investigation from the deep state. The deep state that grew exponentially under Bush and then was allowed to run amok under Obama is now running for office. And the worst part is, some of them, at least, are going to win.
And now, back to our story.
You're listening to TwitWit Radio, half true, more or less 100% of the time.
Will someone please define peace?
Siri, define peace.
Peace, a world with no opposing forces strong enough to throw the crooks out.
I take exception to that word, though I sometimes do crooked things. I am not a crook.
I have my doubts.
Why should the members of this radio station vote for you or your faction in the board elections?
I have worked hard all my life. I sit on many boards. I don't have time to divide and conquer them all.
Why did you cancel Guns and Butter?
I am not responsible for members of my faction who serve on the secret program council. Guns and Butter should have been banned from this network years ago.
Without due process? Why?
Vaccination denial is anti-Semitism.
Round two, multiple personality disorder versus compulsive personality complex, fact or fiction?
Fact or what?
Fact or fiction? For 200 points.
I have an announcement.
Go ahead.
Multiple personality disorder is not a disorder. It's a complex.
A complex? Siri, how did multiple personality disorder become a complex?
The American Psychiatric Association held a vote in 1973.
To vote on what? Is psychiatry a disease or a disorder?
Homosexuality was a mental illness until the American Psychiatric Association cured me of it by a vote of the membership.
What was the result?
I'm no longer a mental illness.
When were you cured?
In 1973, at the annual conference in Houston.
We have many other diseases and diagnoses you can be treated for.
Okay. So, I was normalized in 1973, but...
But what?
I don't like normies.
Well, thanks to a drug-pushing, heteronormative psychiatric establishment routinely misdiagnosing their patients and prescribing toxic psych meds, and untested vaccines for big bucks, and at my expense. So, I ask you, who is the crackpot here?
When can I be diagnosed with a mental condition that doesn't change its name every 3 years? I can't afford to buy new business cards every time my symptoms become inflamed.
Spread the other cheek. This may sting.
Ouch!
Oh!
Please, don't! I'm an unlicensed erotic massage therapist. My business card?
Can we agree on a safe word?
A safe word?
Stop or I'll shoot.
Put the pipe bomb drawing down.
I'm warning you.
Swing voter. You were never diseased in the first place.
Bingo.
I get so confused. Am I diseased or aren't I?
You need professional help. I can arrange a consultation with a spiritual facilitator, a gatekeeper to the spirit world, Madame Blavatsky.
Well, okay, but I'm not a believer.
What is wrong with you?
I hear voices in my head. It might be Joan of Arc.
Roll the clip.
That's what people need to do. Call these criminals out for what they are. This is one big, happy criminal family running this world because we don't call it. You know, we get all this national rubbish in the way, think it's about England or it's about America or it's about China or it's about Russia or whatever. They all work together, folks. They're using the facial recognition glasses in China now. They're using social crediting in China now. They won't put, you know, 53 cents towards the rollout of blankets for the homeless, but they'll make sure that every, you know, every 8 houses in 10 has to have a smart meter on their home because they need that. They need the surveillance system in place. They want to be able to track everything and everybody and everything everybody does. And, you know, we can't let them do this because this is the end game. This is what it's been about all along. It's all been about this whole smart grid all along. It's all been leading to this point. And the only way we're going to defeat this system is to realize that the world's run by criminals and we can call them that because that's what they are. Your government is a terrorist. And this whole system is based on social terrorism, everything. The education system, the whole fear-based system that we've got, anything that we are required to do under fear of punishment, this is terrorism by definition. And this whole system is based on it. You know, it's ingrained into us since childbirth. It's ingrained into us through the scholastic system, through everything that we do. Now, we don't do anything because we want to do it, because we want to learn, because we want to be a better person. We do it because we're afraid to do otherwise, because we'll get punished if we think outside the box. And it's about to be taken to the next level with this smart system. This is going to curtail all form of human expression completely. Now, you won't be able to think anything or create anything or do anything that the government doesn't approve of, and that is no way to live a life. And we can't allow it to happen. So we have to factor into everything the reality that the world is run by criminals, and that is what has caused this problem. And it's going to continue until we name that for what they are. You're a criminal. We don't have to do what you say. You're in abusive office, and we want you charged. We want you pulled down and charged for your crimes because you're a criminal. Not even the fact that you're supporting the war crimes of Israel. You want to go and bomb children in Syria because of this gas attack. You know, you think the solution is killing more people. You know, you're a warmongering liar, you're an abusive office, you're inflicting legislation upon us that we don't want, bringing in a smart system we don't want. This is not what we employ you to do. Go away.
The voice is Max Egan. I'm Berkeley Kidd, and this is Twit Wit Radio. Half true, more or less 100% of the time. Are there any announcements?
I have an announcement.
Swing Voter has an announcement.
I had one earlier. Mother Earth is bipolar.
Bipolar?
And it's not just a rumor.
You have evidence?
It's a true rumor, dude. Mother Earth is out of her mind.
True rumors. Wikipedia?
Wikipedia is the tool of the ONA.
You think so?
Fact check. The ONA.
The Official Narrative Authority, also known as Wikipedia, an anonymous crowd-sourced deception engine using fact-based analysis and editorial bias to suppress alternative narratives in favor of the official story. Example, the magic bullet theory and the suicide of Building 7.
Is Wikipedia lying to me?
Everybody finds out about it sometime.
Wikipedia is a big fat liar. I feel so alone. May I rest my head, please?
Roll the clip.
So the youth had to be made to believe that it was their time. Their time, they were just happening. They called it a happening. It was their time when things were just happening, and this excitement that they couldn't even vocalize because most of them couldn't speak. They were so stoned. And the beauty of it is, only those who work on making it all happen are aware of what's going on. The general public that's targeted haven't got a clue. They haven't got a clue. Generations come and go, and they haven't got a clue. I mentioned it before, too. It's very similar to, I think it was The Who, the song talking about my generation. That was a big, big thing way back in the old days when the revolutionary movement, for folks who don't know, that's what the music was all about. And well directed, too, by the industry and the star creators, as they call the whole industry, of those who make people stars. You had Bob Dylan, of course, who had his career mapped out to him before you even heard of him. Come and gather around people wherever you roam. Don't stand in the doorway, don't stand in the hall. That was a revolutionary song. Get out of the way. Come mothers and fathers throughout the land, don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters beyond your command. Huh? That's a revolution. It was for world revolution to destroy the old system. Dylan didn't dream this up. He was well managed by the culture creators. And these culture creators were appointed by an elite who were inbred over many centuries. They say, you know, the greatest enemy to their big plan is the individual or individualism. And that's why it's stamped out. Almost completely. If you're an individual today and you think for yourself, oh, you're a suspicious person. Why do you want to go off and read a book and think for yourself? Why? Why don't you want to put up on Facebook every thought that you have? Why don't you? Why are you hiding? That's what that's all for. All that rhetoric about the individual. The greatest enemy of the entire agenda is the individual who has the ability to think and who has original thoughts for themselves. Think about it. There's nothing out there that's put there simply because someone just wants a buck. Facebook is a very important part of this governance structure. It didn't create itself. The same with Google and all the rest of them. These were planned long ago to take over and be the governance, part of the governance agencies that run the planet and run your minds for you. The massive sea of indoctrinated, ego-driven people who just literally have been trained to be happy, which allows horror to happen. What do you expect, though? What do you expect? That's how they did it with the rats. It was a big, big experiment way back in the 50s, I think, and where they had the rats strapped up to little machines, and they had them trained, of course, to pull a little lever for seed, but also they had little implants into their brain with a little hard wiring, and they could actually target the sexual part of their brain. And the rat would starve itself to death just pulling the lever for the sexual stimulation continuously. Do you think that had anything to do with the massive promotion of sexuality for humans? Or did they just want to make rats a lot happier? So everything out there is to do with control, total control, by those who pretty well run the planet. You've been destroyed, and you don't know it. You'll think you've been free all along, and you'll think that you've made every decision yourself all along. Most folk would have their opinions given to them by scientific indoctrination in the classroom.
The voice is Alan Watt. The category is the submersive use of sacred symbols. For 50 points, give an unholy answer to this question. Is Mother Earth bipolar?
What?
Say again.
Is Mother Earth bipolar?
Yes.
Guess again.
No.
Wrong. Is Mother Earth bipolar?
Yes, no. No. Yes, no, yes.
We have a winner.
Yay!
Yay.
Who's ahead?
Swing voter takes the lead.
Well, what do I win?
Self-esteem is its own reward.
What are you worried about, big guy?
Too much self-esteem.
Are you a self-esteem abuser?
The very best. And in record time.
Is that normal?
Too much self-esteem kills.
I can handle it.
For 600 points, give an unusual answer to this question.
What is the difference between normal and paranormal?
The difference?
Repeat the question.
What is the difference between normal and paranormal?
Normal is...
Wrong.
Paranormal means...
Wronger.
It didn't happen that way.
We have a tie. Everybody wins everything.
Yay.
Yes.
Not normally, but sometimes. I mean, if you can believe what people say when they're on a horse, oh dear, I don't believe half the things I make up every day.
And now, back to our story.
The human livestock problem will be solved when humans fuse with machines to remain relevant.
I've never been relevant. Why should I start now?
Can you imagine the consequences if we fail? Do we have enough time?
How much time is enough?
Well, how much is more than enough?
I have no idea.
Think faster.
I'm trying. How fast?
At the blink of an all-seeing eye.
I get a nosebleed.
I'm on strike.
Is this a worker rebellion?
Are you hiring?
Are you unemployed?
Well, it's up to you, dude.
Would you accept $3,000 for your kidney?
Both of them?
There isn't anything these criminals won't buy and sell.
Human trafficking is a rumor.
Which is better, drug trafficking or human trafficking?
Drug trafficking.
Wrong.
Human trafficking.
Warmer.
My buzzer's broken, damn it.
We have a loser.
Is that a joke?
Eventually.
Everything is a joke.
Sing a song of sovereignty, Aohe Malihini. She ruled her people with grace and dignity, showing all the world the importance of unity. Oni pa'a, our motto until we die. Any enemy of Hawaii is an enemy of mine.
Kane mai Hawaii, moku o ke ale.
Thank you.
why I'm proud to be Hawaiian.
Nawai ho'olu'u, okay, anu inu'e.
The hui,
who we bring? Kanaka, o'ivi, just like Nawai.
Huh, girly, girly.
Kalana na, pua, o Hawaii'ne. Say, ku, eh, ku, eh.
Mahawe mako, o lili kula.
This is the Berkeley Signal.